Davis says this: the Germans may be trying to build up the reputation for accuracy during the early period of the invasion so that they can put one over later. When Elmer Davis made this statement, he was sitting at his OWI desk in rolled-up shirt sleeves. He listened to General Eisenhower's message to the European people and commented on the fine voice of the invasion chief. Now, this has been a sleepless night for much of Washington. But until 3:32 a.m. Eastern wartime this morning, we had no official confirmation of German reports that the invasion of Europe is actually underway. That report came from London. You heard it over the National Broadcasting Company at 3:32 a.m. this morning. And shortly after London flashed the first word of the Nazi claim that we were attacking across the Channel, the information staffs of the Army and the Navy and the Office of War Information began reporting for duty here in our capital. Colonel Albert Warner, the head of the Army Bureau of Public Relations, ordered out his staff on the basis, apparently, of the German reports. Then Commander W.G. Beecher, who is acting director of the Navy's public relations, was on the job early with his assistants. And Elmer Davis, director of the Office of War and Information, showed up at his office looking as if he had dressed hurriedly. Well, at the White House, the president's mansion was virtually dark. There were only two lights showing, one in the Secret Service room on the first floor and the other at the White House police gate, which leads to the president's office. Mr. Roosevelt retired early last evening after his radio address to the country last night following the liberation of Rome. But the president obviously knew that tonight was the invasion night and that 3:30 a.m. Eastern Wartime, June 6, 1944, was the time for the official formal announcement. Well, the War Department's famed Pentagon building, which is called the nerve center of the war, looked nothing like that as the reports rolled in after midnight. Outside the building was one cab driver asleep in his car, and inside were a few sleepy guards who had heard no news of this historic report. Now, the press section was the only place in the huge building that showed any activity, and most of that was supplied for the first few hours by newspaper reporters seeking confirmation of the German reports. That is a picture of the news and situation in Washington at this hour this morning, and here is Morgan Beatty, NBC staff commentator of Washington.
Thank you, Dick Harkness. The military reports we've received up to now, most of them, were a part of advance planning for the invasion, some of them recordings made in preparation for the attack or just as the assault began, all fitting into plans to advise us accurately, as rapidly as possible, about what was afoot. Some days ago, I sat in Washington with an Army officer who told me in outline what those plans were, including the voice of General Eisenhower, the voice you heard not very long ago. This was a part of operations, the recognition by the armed forces of the necessity of informing the world public as well as fighting the enemy. Naturally, all of this was held back in London until 0 hour had passed. The Germans were given the first opportunity to report the facts, and they did report them, as Dick Harkness told you, perhaps fairly accurately. In any event, however, we won't know until a matter of 72 hours has passed when the German counterattacks will begin. For that reason, we should take with some reserve reports of heavy fighting at this stage. The Germans have long planned to hold back, to wait before they strike back at us in earnest. Now, let's look at this area of northern France where the battle has been joined. We have here the makings of an attack intended to gain, as you've been told before, a major port or ports in France right off the bat. This means that the Allies have chosen the most audacious of all assaults against Fortress Europe at the outset. It's obvious that they are intended to gain the means of landing the greatest number of troops in the shortest period of time against the enemy. It's been estimated by competent authorities that any attack by the Allies or series of attacks in the area of France we're discussing should land at least 6 divisions per day for at least 3 days hand running, all in those 3 days, with heavy air and sea support as well as troops landed on the surface. Here's the reason for this sort of Allied planning. Normandy can absorb only limited numbers of fighting forces on both sides. The Germans, for example, are supposed to be holding in readiness in that area some 20 divisions, or rather back of that area, to counterattack the Allies. Thus, the Allied tactics at the moment would seem to be to land as many troops as possible, as rapidly as possible, to be ready to meet the main German forces held further back. And now that invasion has begun, the preliminary stages will be preparation for the German counterattack. That counterattack presumably cannot be mustered for at least 3 days, as we've noted. It's also noteworthy that the Allies have chosen a strip of France ideally suited for naval support, the strip between Le Havre and the Seine and the Normandy Peninsula. The Germans have a tremendous natural advantage in any invasion effort, the advantage of defensive land forces as against forces borne by sea and air. They also have serious disadvantages. The disadvantages spring from the nature of the German organization across the Channel, the military organization. The enemy keeps only small forces on the coast. Towns and important points are, however, garrisoned as local strong points. That explains why some of the fire, the anti-aircraft fire, reported to you earlier in the evening, was scattered. Le Havre, of course, is such a strong point. And in between these strong points, there are local patrols, patrols backed by general support further back. Thus, the whole German problem along the Channel coast is to determine which attack from the Allies is the real thing, so that their support forces can be called up accurately. If they fail in this piece of preliminary detective work, they'll find their main support forces wasting their time on empty coastal areas, while Allied forces elsewhere make headway against very small protective garrisons. It's General Eisenhower's hope that the Germans will fail in their detective work. In the background, of course, the Germans have their own information as to our preparations, information which they are careful to keep away from us. So far, their information seems to be, however, fairly accurate. The Allied job at the moment is to prevent the Germans from knowing where to begin or to bring their support forces, their reinforcements for a coastal area, an area that is, in fact, lightly held except for their coastal guns. It's noteworthy also that the Germans discovered the Dieppe raiders 2 years ago through their naval patrols. They depended on these patrols last night again to signal the first Allied activities that departed from the normal. It's on the report of these patrols that their support forces farther back must be called up. The Germans, we note, gauged the first Allied attack correctly. The German forces, the main forces, defending the part of France behind Le Havre and similar coastal areas, are probably based 20 to 40 miles back of the Atlantic. It's also probable that your German left flank is based on Saint-Nazaire on the Atlantic, and their right flank on the Meuse River in Belgium. Between these 2 points, some 300 miles, the main defense line runs along the Sarthe River to the Seine, north of Paris, then into Belgium along the Oise River. The Germans, by their reports to date, clearly indicate that they expect the Allies are trying to flush their defenses in this general line, that we are aiming either at Brittany or Normandy, presumably Normandy exclusively to date, or Le Havre itself, the port for Paris. Thus, the lines of battle up to now have been drawn. Some months ago, Colonel Conrad H. Lanza, retired of the United States Army, surveyed this area of France and surveyed it extremely accurately. Here's what he said. At the west end of Normandy, the Cotentin Peninsula again suggests a desirable invasion area. As in Brittany, at the outer end of the peninsula is an excellent port in every way suitable for major bases. That would be Le Havre. The west side of the peninsula has extensive and good beaches, nearly all at the foot of cliffs. These are not an important hindrance for foot troops, but they are a decided obstacle to vehicles. In places, rocks abound off this coast. As far north as Brittany, a sea approach to this area must pass the enemy-held Channel Islands. It must therefore be presumed that an invasion would be known to the enemy for 4 or more hours before it reaches the shore. As a matter of fact, we can now report, although this report was written months ago, we can now report that the Germans did discover the attack apparently 3 hours ahead of time. The east side of the Cotentin Peninsula, that is, the Normandy area, is low and favorable for landing. The north end is precipitous, and it's a part of the east coast and included in extensive fortified areas covering Cherbourg. In spite of numerous bombings, this city has been regularly used by enemy sea traffic, and by the same token, we can, apparently, use that port as soon as we can get our hands on it. However, the enemy could assemble his troops opposite the Cotentin Peninsula in less time than we could assault that force with heavy forces. Landing areas limited to the south of Cherbourg would have a front of no more than 20 miles. Within this space, the force that can be landed is not large enough to be probably sufficient to overcome enemy resistance. And now, we return you back to Dick Harkness in the newsroom.
Good morning, and this is Richard Harkness in the NBC newsroom in Washington. And now I'm bringing you an interesting sidelight on the invasion operations you've been hearing about during the last few hours this morning. Here in Washington, in many ways an international city, there is a little bit of France, a little bit of Belgium, the Netherlands, Norway, and nearly every other country involved in this battle of Europe. Now, I am referring, of course, to these countries' embassies and legations. And these are, in effect, branch offices of these foreign governments. And the diplomats who live and work here probably are better informed than anyone else on what's been happening inside their country since the Germans marched in. And sitting across the table from me this morning is Henri Opinot, the French Committee of National Liberation's minister to the United States. Now, Mr. Opinot was, until the fall of France, one of the leading officials of the French Foreign Office, and he was one of the sharpest proponents of an anti-Axis policy. He has represented General de Gaulle in Washington since last September, and he knows a great deal about conditions inside France during the Germans' occupation. Mr. Minister, can you tell our NBC listeners this morning what's been happening in your country during the years it's been waiting for liberation?
Mr. Harkness, allow me first of all to say that the moment so eagerly awaited by Frenchmen is now at hand. After 4 years of enemy occupation, of moral and physical suffering, the French people's hopes for salvation is today greater than ever, and is equaled only by their will to fight the Nazis. The Allied have landed. These magic words are passed along from mouth to mouth, whilst impatient and daring Frenchmen are listening closely to the voice telling them from London and Alger what they should do to help the Allies. On this occasion, I want to thank the American people, who, as a whole, have worked so hard to make this landing possible, and to the relatives of those who are fighting now on French soil, I want to convey the deep sympathy of our people. They are now, as in 1917, the brother-in-arms of French soldiers in the struggle of liberation. I wish them and their commander-in-chief swift success and a victory worthy of their fathers.
Well, Mr. Minister, could you tell us what active support the French underground will be able to give to our armies now that they've landed?
The people of France have suffered under German occupation long enough to hate the enemy. They will do all they can to help their allies. And when I say that, I'm not making rash promises. We know already that the underground has been helped on many occasions, quite spontaneously, by French men and women who sympathize with their allies, but who were not actual members of the underground. Let me remind you also of the heroic stand taken by the population of Saint-Nazaire during the famous English commando raid on March 28, 1942. Then the whole civilian population of that Breton port arose to help the British commando and fought for 3 days against the German garrison. They paid dearly for it, not only during the battle, but also during German reprisals. More than 600 French men and women perished during those 3 days. The spirit of Saint-Nazaire is typical of the spirit of the French nation. More recently, the town of Grenoble in the Alps was awarded the cross of liberation for its action against the German barracks and German depots, which were blown up after the Germans refused to free some 50 hostages taken from the population of Grenoble in reprisal for other previous acts of sabotage. The French underground know that it can't count on the help of ordinary Frenchmen and women when the time comes for them to do their part by the side of their lives.
But Mr. Minister, hasn't the underground been pretty well crushed by German arrests and deportations?
I cannot, of course, divulge the secret of the organization of the underground, but I can tell you that 4 years of underground fighting has prepared the underground for today's task, that it's still organized in spite of German measures taken at the time of the Allies' landing. Whenever one leader falls, two or three are ready to replace them.
Well, we have heard here in Washington, Mr. Minister, that the underground was lacking in arms. Is this still true?
Every fighter in the underground is not yet fully equipped, but the underground has shown great resourcefulness in obtaining its equipment. It has, first of all, helped itself from the arms depot left over when the French Armistice Army was demobilized in 1942. And then it has also used some of the Italian army material that was abundant at the time of the confusion created by the Italian armistice. Also, it has often attacked German depots for the purpose of gathering guns, grenades, and ammunition. And finally, the Allies have found means of conveying to the underground the indispensable equipment for the participation of organized groups in a modern war.
Well, thank you, Mr. Henri Aubineau, Minister to Washington from the French Committee of National Liberation.
Thank you, Dick Harkness, Monsieur Aubineau, and Morgan Beatty. Now NBC continues its coverage of the invasion. We return you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
The National Broadcasting Company continues its coverage by taking you to David Anderson in London.
After 8 hours, there was practically no sign of German army transport on any of the roads in the whole of the invasion area. At 1:30 yesterday afternoon, I entered the gates of an RAF station. Little did I realize at the time that within hours, the big show would be on. And yet, no sooner had I checked in with the adjutant than I was told that I couldn't leave the station under any circumstances until after 8 hours. Though I was prepared to stay for several days, I didn't fancy the idea of spending an indefinite period of time in a cold, windy tent. That's all the housing accommodation offered on a tactical field. And suppliers and crew must be prepared to move camp on short notice. But my fears of a long isolation were short-lived. The adjutant introduced me to the group captain, the youngest, incidentally, in the entire RAF. He's only 27, and yet it seemed that he looked considerably older yesterday. The climax in tactical bombing was to be reached last night. I sensed this immediately as he smiled briefly and said out of the corner of his mouth, "I've been waiting for this for a long time." He was full of apologies when he told me that he couldn't take me on an operational flight. If I were to go, it would mean that one of the pilots would have to fly without a navigator. On these vital D-Day operations, that would be suicidal, he said. But he did consent to take me up for a short hop. He called it a flip, in order that I might get a better picture of the job facing the pilots, and so that I might see some of the ships waiting to hit the beaches. We took off and struck out for one of the invasion ports. It was at a place where Jerry had done core reconnaissance work. For miles, I saw ships dotting the water below. These were some of the ships which even now are touching the north coast of France. Even though I was impressed with the size of this convoy, the group captain told me that this was a comparatively small-sized convoy. We circled back to the field, and I could see that the groupie's thoughts were engrossed in the operation due to begin in a very few hours. I knew, too, that he was disappointed, since he had mentioned that he was grounded on D-Day. He could be of too much use to the enemy had he been captured. After we had landed, the group captain went out to attend to last-minute details, but not before he had offered me all of the facilities at his disposal. This offer included a glimpse into the Holy of Holies, his map room. For days, guards had been posted there, both outside and inside this room. Some were armed with Bren guns. Others carried rifles with fixed bayonets. The enemy at all costs must be kept away from this vital information. Information which, it has been proven, he did not possess. I was able to roam around the field at will and to participate in the briefings for this D-Day operation. There were two of these. The one was conducted by the group captain and the other by the respective wing commanders. The first was quite general, a final brushing up on bombing and strapping tactics. I was particularly impressed by the emphasis laid on the safety factor, the proper height from which to bomb, the obstacles to be encountered, and a reminder to the pilots to judge their height above ground correctly in order to avoid running into the side of a hill. The second briefing concerned the flight itself, the D-Day operation. Although no one was told that H hour would come when he was over the north coast of France, a matter of security in case of one of them fell into the hands of the enemy, there was no one in the briefing room who doubted that his was a D-Day job. This could be seen by the tenseness with which each man listened. Everyone was anxious to get on with the job, to try the next step in the tactical air warfare, which is designed to keep the Germans from moving into the operational area. I stood with the group captain and watched the planes take off. Hardly had the first plane taxied to the head of the runway when he turned to me and said, "That's where I should have been." "But they can't keep me out of the air tomorrow," he continued. One by one, the planes circle overhead to get their final bearings before making the flight to this all-important coast of France. Each man had his area of attack. Each man knew what was expected of him. But as I watched the planes take off, I noticed something strange, something brand new for the Germans to see. No longer were the planes camouflaged. Last night, for the first time, these planes bore the markings of the Allied Expeditionary Air Force. These markings consist of alternate black and white stripes on the wings and belly. These markings, I understand, were put on all Allied planes by order of General Eisenhower in order that Allied ships would have an easier task in distinguishing them between friend and foe. This is essential in an operation of this magnitude. As a matter of fact, the paint hardly had time to dry, since this was all last-minute work. From the airfield, we went into the control room. There was nothing to do now but wait. I noticed the estimated time of return and strolled through the control tower. I was waiting in the briefing room once again, as the first pilots reported. Their task had been to hunt out and shoot up or bomb any German transport on the roads on the French coast. From the very beginning, it was hoped that none would be seen. This would be a definite indication that the Hun didn't know where we were going to land. And as the boys came back, one by one, this hope was realized. Except for a few scattered cars on the road, nothing was seen. Most of the pilots saw no transport whatsoever, so they concentrated on bombing road junctions and railways. The Germans were caught napping. The work of this RAF tactical group was only one part of a gigantic program. Before these boys had finished their missions, the airborne troops, British and American, were dropped in their appointed places. Then RAF bombers went out to work on the landing beaches. They dropped between 6,000 to 8,000 tons of bombs. Capacity loads were carried last night. Shortly before dawn, the Allied naval guns began shelling the beach area. And at the same time, American liberators and fortresses took over where the RAF left off. Before the sun had risen over the horizon, Allied troops were landed behind a smoke screen. They were guided to the landing beaches by markers set out by midget submarines, which spent 3 days in crossing the channel to carry out this most important but hazardous task. Now, the Allies are on the beaches in force. Ahead of them are the airborne troops. Between them and in front of the airborne troops are the Germans. The job has just begun. And yet, as I left the RAF station a couple of hours ago, I came away with a feeling that the reports brought back by the flyers were just those that we had hoped for. The Hun was surprised. Now it's up to us to take advantage of this. I now return you to the United States.
The National Broadcasting Company continues its worldwide news coverage of this epic-making event, the invasion of France by the Allies, with a broadcast and report by H.B. Kaltenborn.
Good morning, everybody. Let me summarize for you some of the various broadcasts that many of you may have been listening to for the last 3 hours. Our first news of the invasion came from the Germans at approximately 1 o'clock this morning. And here is what they told us in detail. It's interesting because obviously we know now that at least the invasion part of it is true, and it is quite possible that they are giving us additional information to that which the Allied command has thus far released. The Germans say early this Tuesday morning, numerous landing craft and light warships were observed in the area between the mouth of the Seine and the eastern coast of Normandy. That is confirmed by everything that we have heard since as to the place of the landing. That is a very favorable strip of French coast. There is more flat land in that area than almost anywhere else. It is an ideal place for parachute landings, glider landings. It is strategically located with reference to the French railroads. It is, although some 80 miles from the British coast, also favorably located with regard to the British ports, and is, from our point of view, an ideal place for landing. At one end is Le Havre, the most important French port in northern France, which, if we can secure it, will ease our problem of landing tremendously, for obviously these first landings are only a tiny fraction of what is going to follow. And also, it runs on up to Cherbourg, another important port, also connected with Paris, with France, with Belgium, by important railroad lines. Obviously, those railroad lines have been in good part destroyed, but once we isolate certain sections of the French coast, conquer them, we can very readily restore them. This, then, is the place of the first invasion. But remember that the first invasion will undoubtedly be followed by several others. Just a few minutes ago came a bulletin that the Berlin radio, monitored by NBC today, broadcast that strong enemy air attacks have been launched on the Dieppe area. Well, now Dieppe is much farther to the north and to the west, and Dieppe is also a tremendously important French port closer to the Belgian frontier, controlling a different network of railroads. And it is quite possible that invasion number two will be in the Dieppe area. And so we must expect that hour by hour we will hear of landings at other points. The Germans go on and tell us, at the same time, paratroops were dropped from numerous aircraft on the northern tip of the Normandy Peninsula. And we have had this morning picturesque, dramatic accounts of how our planes, our transports carrying these paratroops, flew over the channel under the light of a bright moon, the channel smooth, and found very little activity on the invasion coast. And according to all the reports that have reached us, the invasion safely and successfully begun. It is believed, the Germans say, that these paratroops have been given the task of capturing airfields in order to facilitate the landing of further paratroops. That is undoubtedly true, and I venture the prediction that since we have probably landed these paratroops at specific airfields, that at least one or more are already in our possession. German naval forces, we are told, have engaged enemy landing craft off the coast. There is no report that has come to us from Allied sources that indicates that German naval forces in any strength are present. Fighting is proceeding, we know, 10 miles inland, and other indications from those who accompanied our paratroops indicate that possibly we have penetrated as far as 16 miles in our first invasion effort. General Eisenhower's order of the day was transmitted to you, in which he began by telling his men, "You are about to embark on the great crusade." We had a broadcast from one of the landing craft en route to France, and the picture that we got from that landing craft was of a tremendous armada making its way across the channel to the French coast. Yes, even the initial invasion is on an enormous scale, a far larger amphibious operation than any so far in all recorded history. General Eisenhower also broadcast to the enslaved countries of Europe, and I was impressed with his emphasis on France. He said that he was proud to have the gallant forces of France under his command, that obedience to all orders was essential from now on, that order in France would be preserved by Frenchmen wherever Allied troops land and take control, and gave them the promise again that they will be permitted to choose their own government as soon as that is possible. He asked them to cooperate in every way possible, told them that everything would be done that could be done to mitigate the hardships of invasion, and pointed out that French resistance thus far to the German invader has been an inspiring example. A new phase of the air offensive has started, a BBC broadcast declared. It will affect the entire coastal zone situated not less than 35 kilometers inland from the French coast. That's 20-odd miles, indicating that our landings will penetrate much farther inland than they have thus far in the first stage. We've had messages from various Allied leaders. The King of Norway spoke in Norwegian to his people, and he suggested to me very definitely in what he said the possibility of early landings in Norway. For he did not, as did the Prime Minister of Netherlands and the Prime Minister of Belgium, emphasize so much that the time for their resistance had not yet come. And now, I'll let you listen to the first official invasion announcement as broadcast from General Eisenhower's headquarters.
This is Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force. The text of communique number one will be released to the press and radio of the United Nations in 10 seconds. Repeat, 10 seconds from now. Command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. The communique will be repeated. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number one from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
There was a very interesting broadcast that came to us from the Prime Minister of the Netherlands. He asked his fellow countrymen to pass on his words, but to do so only to trustworthy compatriots. He told them that the Dutch forces would have to fulfill their allotted task, and then gave them their orders. And he emphasized, as did several of the other commanders and chieftains of the countries Norway, Denmark, Belgium, the fact that the orders given do not apply to the organized resistance forces. This indicates very definitely that we have already organized resistance forces in all the occupied countries, and that these general broadcasts that went out this morning are intended for the people as a whole, and that we have other means, secret means, for reaching the leaders of the organized resistance forces. And so, these broadcasts from the King of Norway, from the Prime Minister of Belgium, and the Prime Minister of the Netherlands were intended to give special instructions to the people as a whole, not to those who are going to lead the active resistance when the time comes. And here is what the Prime Minister of the Netherlands asked of his people. One, that they engage in no acts of violent open resistance. Two, that any such act would invite reprisals on others and therefore must be avoided. Three, that there should be all possible passive resistance. Four, that they should refrain from any act that would be of advantage to the enemy. Five, that they should watch closely their own behavior and that they should listen to instructions as frequently and constantly as possible. And six, that when more forceful action is needed from the people as a whole, they would be advised. The purpose of this is to prevent the Germans from provoking resistance before the time has come, and in that way perhaps to discover the leaders of the resistance movement. We had an excellent broadcast from Wright Bryan, managing editor of the Atlantic Journal and reporter for WSB, NBC's Atlanta affiliate. He gave us the story of the landing of the first spearhead paratroops. He watched 17 out of 18 men leave a plane, pointed out to us that very few tracers were met, that there was practically no resistance to the first phase of the air invasion, that there was no sign of Allied escorting fighter planes, but also no German fighter planes. And that is important because that means that the aerial opposition to the invasion was slight indeed. Taking everything into account, it is evident to us here in the NBC newsroom that the first phase of the invasion has been carried through successfully. It is in large force. We have landed at several important points. We are going forward with every indication of continued success.
H.V. Kaltenbaum has just brought you a summary of this night's historic events. Again, ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned to your NBC station for NBC's worldwide coverage of the news as it happens. And now, the Stars and Stripes Forever. Just heard the Stars and Stripes Forever. And now, a brief pause for station identification.
WEAF, New York.